pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, everybody. Where can you believe it? We're up to episode 17.
17, eh?
Yes. Yeah. And welcome, Scott. You've butted in there, Scott. I hadn't welcomed you yet.
I apologise.
Welcome now. So, yes, episode 17, folks, the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. And once again, we're taking a look at Australian news and political events as viewed through secular coloured glasses. And, Scott, once again, all sorts of players have been in the action this week, and there's
they
stuff
have.
To talk about. Yeah,
they have. Yeah, there's not been a hell of a lot that's been really bizarre, but there's been a couple of things that have made you cringe a little bit. But anyway,
It might be that our sensibilities have been, I don't know, so perverted by the things that the crazy religious right says that we're actually. You know, they come out with stuff now and we think, oh, it's not so bad. But really, in the cold light of day, you go, holy heck, that's terrible what they've just said. So we might have become desensitised, Scott.
Quite potentially, yes. So, yeah,
anyway,
quite
let's hope not. They've got to keep the fire burning. But anyway, the topic of the week for me so far has been the Human Rights Commission has called for a round table, basically a conference, examining religious freedom. So they're calling it a religious freedom round table. And last year, the Human Rights Commission called for some submissions. And then in September, they sort of asked for more submissions on certain topics. And apparently, on the 5th of November, there's going to be some roundtable, I assume in Canberra, where a bunch of people are going to sit around, interested parties, and talk about religious freedom with the Human Rights Commission. On the face of it, Scott, sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, until you read just how those people were actually selected to be part of it all.
Yeah, so a bit of a press release put out. Listeners, we have previously spoken about Brian Morris, who wrote a book called Sacred to Secular, and he's come out in the news during the week and on radio and basically accusing the Human Rights Commission of bias in this regard. So he's saying, and it's a little bit unclear exactly, but something along the lines of 200 invitations were sent out to make submissions, but only 4 of those went to secular organisations.
Mm-hmm.
The rest went to faith groups. And he's saying that at the forum, there will be 40 representatives from Australian churches and faith-based institutions, but only 4 secular organisations. And I think he got hold of some email, but I actually wrote to him to ask him how he had this information and hasn't come back to me. But
right.
If all that's true, that just doesn't seem like a fair process, Scott.
No, I wouldn't have thought it would be fair. I mean, clearly it's almost like the roundtable's got to already worked out what they want to, what the result of the roundtable wants to be.
Mm.
And as a result, they've turned around and said, rightio, well, these are the people that we need involved.
I mean, the non-religious in Australia is a huge percentage, yet when it comes to that round table, if everybody gets a chance to speak, then they're just going to be so outweighed by all the different faiths chipping in for their 2 cents worth. And
well, there'll be 196 people.
Yes.
And who are from a faith background, and then 4 who aren't.
And while those people might have their differences in theology, they're all pretty much united in the sense of expecting, you know, religions to be able to carry on in the public sphere, you know, with their privileged positions and sort of maintaining the privilege and perhaps extending the privilege that religions already have. So while they might be, you know, different in theology, they're going to be backing each other in that argument. And so you're just going to have a massive number of voices against a very few on a very crucial issue. So so that just seemed strange to me until I read a little bit more. And again, this came from Brian Morris from his Plain Reason website. And he sort of had a look at this Tim Wilson, who is the Human Rights Commissioner. And he said that when Tim Wilson was appointed, he was dubbed the Freedom Commissioner. In principle, that may sound laudable, but we might also consider that prior to his role with the Human Rights Commission, he was a policy director with the conservative think tank, the Institute of Public Affairs. That worries me. A conservative think tank. And then shortly after assuming his new role, he gave a speech at the Catholic University titled The Forgotten Freedom of Worship. And in it he said, in short, religion is about everyone's relationship to their creator.
Yeah.
I don't know that this is my pick for somebody in charge of the Human Rights Commission.
No, I tend to agree with you too. And when you go further into it... The point I was going to make was his final bit point on the article that you printed out, so I'll leave that till the end. I won't steal your thunder on that. But, you know, it's a disturbing thing that when you've got someone who's the Human Rights Commissioner has come around and said that this is... What were the exact words? He said this is a relationship between you and your creator.
Yeah, in short, religion is about everyone's relationship to their creator.
Yeah.
And his the title of his speech was The Forgotten Freedom of Worship.
Yeah. Yeah, it's odd.
With a conservative think tank background. Gosh. It's, you know, this is why you've got to know people's backgrounds and motivations, haven't you? I mean,
well, you do. Yeah.
Make sense when you find out what people's motivations are. So, so that might partly explain some of this. And then, you know, when they're calling for submissions and they had sort of four sort of topics that they wanted people to make submissions on.
Yeah.
And also with that, they had 11 guiding principles that they wanted the round table to sort of have as guiding principles in the discussions. And so the secular party put in a submission. So we responded to these sort of four topics, and we also responded to the guiding principles. And John, our president, wrote that response, and I reckon it's a really good response, and that's on the secular party website. But just to give you some of the flavour of this talk fest that's going to be the round table... In the guiding principles, the 11 guiding principles for the discussion, number 3, religious freedom has an essential and important role in public life or civic affairs to contribute to the moral and spiritual guidance of our nation.
Yeah, go on. Next.
No, we don't have to all agree to that as a guiding principle. And then further on in guiding principle number 10, individuals and communities of faith will continue to constructively work with government and other public agencies to uphold the law and improve Australia's moral and spiritual guidance. Like, this assumption that A, Australia needs spiritual guidance, and B, communities of faith that are well positioned to provide it. Gosh, it annoys me, Scott.
Well, and frankly, I don't blame you either. It's absurd, you know, to have this sort of... have the assumption that... what's the word I'm groping for? The assumption that that everything we need to get our moral guidance comes from a religion is offensive.
Yes. And just the notion of spiritual guidance as being accepted by everybody as a necessary thing is just...
Yeah.
So anyway, in the Secular Party submission, John rightfully pointed out Secular Party disagreement with those particular items. And the really part I liked about his submission to the Human Rights Commission on this topic was he really emphasised freedom, you know, from religion as part of the United Nations Charter.
Yeah.
And he said that applies to children, their people, and indoctrination of children goes against that. And so that was the key sort of theme of his submission, which I really liked. And, you know, when... now, I think... You know, I got a feeling, Scott, before I went away on holidays, that I just heard a vague thing about this submission, and I think I mentioned it at a meeting and said, does anybody know about this and we need to put in a submission? Like, it wasn't very well advertised, this.
No, this it wasn't snuck well up on advertised. It has just sort of snuck up on me too, but, I mean, it is one of those things that, you know, you'd have to be really looking for it to find where they're advertising
it. Well, you know what? Like, for the last 17 weeks... we've been scouring the internet, checking magazine articles, like keeping our finger right on the pulse.
Hmm.
And, you know, when this all blew up in the last week, I was going, now what's all this about again? Like,
exactly.
I only briefly crossed my eyes just before I went on holidays, and that was it. So I think it's been poorly publicised. I think invitations have gone straight to faith groups, and... we've managed to put in a submission, and I checked with John, and guess what? We haven't been invited to the roundtable.
Well, it's hardly surprising, really, was it?
So, anyway, putting on my hat as Secular Party spokesman, I've written and said, you know, the allegations by Brian Morris about, you know, 40 faith groups and only 4 secular groups, is that correct? And then I've also said in that, you know, why weren't we invited? We're a national organisation with a history of involvement in this. You know, why? How did we miss out on a ticket? So, haven't got a response, but I only sent that today. So give them a few more days and see what happens. But interestingly, Scott, Rationalist Society of Australia, are you aware of them?
Yes, I'm aware of them, yeah.
Yeah. So... they do some good stuff, like they are not affiliated with the Secular Party at all, but they often promote secular-type ideas and sort of rationalist ideas, and they're kind of a bit like... who's that British author? The Richard Dawkins type of group in their publications, you know, a bit of rational thinking, bit of... secular thinking, a bit of science, that sort of mix. Yep. And they put in a submission to the Human Rights Commission.
Okay. And
they were really soft.
Really? Like,
yes. So they basically... because one of the issues that's come up recently, and we mentioned it last week, were these... some of these religious leaders talking about the gay marriage and the wedding service providers, so people like bakeries not wanting to make wedding cakes for gay couples.
Yes.
And these groups, or fairly high up people, like, you know, Catholic Archbishop of Sydney is saying this sort of stuff, that yeah, you know, a bakery shouldn't be forced to make a wedding cake for a gay couple if they don't want to. Should be able to object. So the Rationalist Society is more or less kind of supporting that idea.
Why?
Well, they said... they said... here's a sort of analogy they gave. In Victoria and Tasmania, doctors can refuse services for abortion as long as they disclose it up front and refer the patient to someone who can help them. This effectively balances doctors' potential conscientious objection and women's rights to legal health services. Applying this logic to same-sex marriage, Service providers could refuse services as long as they disclose their policy in advance, apply it consistently, and offer information about alternative service providers. This is from the Rationalist Society, Scott.
Well, I wouldn't have thought they're being particularly rational in that regard, are they?
Here's the difference. I can accept that a doctor doesn't want to perform abortions, but they don't pick and choose when they perform abortions. Like, they can't say, a heterosexual couple, Catholic, okay, you can have an abortion. Oh, lesbian couple, in vitro, or whatever, you know, I'm not going to give you an abortion. Like, the thing about the abortion thing is they can't pick and choose and discriminate depending on who walks in the door. And that's what is going to happen with the bakeries under this thing, is they're going to say, well, you know, I make wedding cakes, but I just don't make wedding cakes for you. So, you know, the argument is, if you don't want to, if you really, really don't want to make a wedding cake for a gay couple, then don't make any wedding cakes. Don't, you know, A, and potentially B, don't have a bakery, if that's your problem. But, you know, if you say, I don't make wedding cakes, that's fine. But if you say, I make wedding cakes for some people and not for others because of whether they're gay or whether they're black or whether they're Jewish, then that's not okay.
Yeah.
Does it need more explanation as to why that's not okay?
Look, I wouldn't have thought so. I would have thought it was all self-evident too. I mean, to me, it just doesn't make any sense.
This is, you know, this is unfair discrimination. Sometimes discrimination is okay when it's required for the merits of a job or something, but this is... You know, you always got to look at this in terms of, would it be okay to apply the same rule just because somebody's black? And you know, that soon shows up whether it's a legitimate argument or not. And I just, I can't believe. And Brian Morris from the Sacred to Secular, it's part of his press release in that, he couldn't believe that the Rationalist Society had come out with such a weak response in their submission. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, some strange stuff's come out recently, but,
Yeah. So, you know, when we say, is there not much strange stuff, I mean, you know, the Catholic Archbishop of Sydney is still coming out in his Acton lecture. You know, proposing this sort of bakery scenario that we've talked about. I had a bit of a look through his Acton lecture, and
I did like the sort of sound of what he's talking about, this 9 years hence.
Yeah, he sort of starts off with, you know, imagine a future in 2025, and then he paints a scenario which he obviously thinks is terrible, but you and I, Scott, think is pretty damn
quite
marvelous.
All right, yeah. Which, I did like this, you know, I assume you're talking about the religion ethics contents from the ABC, the opinion, blah, 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 blah. We get down here, the year is 2025, 9 years after a plebiscite narrowly approved same-sex marriage. I mean, what a load of nonsense.
Yes, yes.
You know, it's just, anyway, do go on, sorry.
But in there's one paragraph that I'm going to have a bit of fun with.
Okay.
And he says, you know, the religious right now are talking about what an unfair run they're getting on their gay marriage sort of argument, and that, you know, they're being discriminated harshly against. And as soon as they put their head up over the parapet to make an argument against gay marriage, everybody shoots at them, and it's totally unfair and unreasonable. And he said this... when people like me enter the fray on marriage, we now expect to be tagged ultra-conservative, tedious imbecile, delusional nutter, evangelical clap-trapper, and even nauseating piece of filth. Now, I would say, Scott, that I would never think of him as a nauseating piece of filth. That would be going too far. But I don't know. Evangelical Claptrapper, Delusional Nutter, and Tedious Imbecile. Like, they were all,
yeah, I think they're all fairly reasonable sort of things to refer to a person like this, don't you think?
They're all up for grabs. So, you know, he has a bit of a whinge that... he has a whinge about Q&A, you know.
Yeah.
Despite religious people getting a seat on that show 2 out of 3 weeks, he's got a... You know, his gripe is that... When they do appear on that, any argument on Q&A eventually turns to gay marriage, and people like him are referred to as delusional nutters. So suck it up, I say, Archbishop Anthony Fisher. So so that's the main bit I got from his Acton lecture. I don't know about you, Scott.
Look, that was probably the main part that I was reading about. Probably the most interesting part was his first bit where he talked about this dystopian future that sounds really good. But he said, you know, already one Catholic bishop has briefly been jailed for refusing to apply the state-approved LGBTIQQ safety protocols awareness program. I mean, what garbage is that? Mm. You know, it's just an absurd thing to suggest. Anyway. But yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting sort of look into the future, and he was carrying on about how terrible things would be and all that sort of stuff, but really, when you look at it, I thought it was a pretty good... it looked like a pretty nice place to be, really.
Yeah. So, you know, his speech was titled Acton Lecture on Religion and Freedom.
Right.
And, you know, this Human Rights Commission thing that's coming up is a round table on religious freedom, and I'm starting to sense, Scott, the use of the word freedom and religion, I see it as the argument that hardline religious people are introducing this word freedom.
Yes. It's happening a lot more, hasn't
it? Yeah, and they're abusing that word to imply that restricting religious activity is a violation of a freedom that that shouldn't happen. And
look, that's very much out of the American context. Like, you know, the Americans have got the freedom of religious bills and all that sort of stuff before their state legislature and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And, you know, and as a result, it's you've ended up with a situation where you've got people that have been able to be discriminated against and so on and so forth because of, you know, in inverted commas, people's religious freedom, you know, which is just nonsense.
Yeah, so I can't remember. It's one of those famous American guys who's always known for quoting things, and he came out with a phrase which was that your freedom or right to swing your fist ends just before my nose. And
yeah.
It's a really good way of thinking of these things. Like,
exactly.
Your freedom to practice kooky religious beliefs stops when it causes harm to other people or our society. So religious groups and their notion of freedom have to remember that.
Yeah, agreed. And, you know, it's just... Anyway, it's absurd to listen. It's absurd to read all this sort of stuff that is on there available from him. So this is the Most Reverend Anthony Fisher.
Mm.
He's the Archbishop from the Catholic Archdiocese of Sydney. Mm.
I mean, this is the other thing, Scott, is often these, you know, religious nutters in America are some obscure pastor in some hillbilly town in the deep south, you know, in a 10-person shack or something.
Yeah, where you would expect this sort of nonsense to come from.
But we're getting this from the archbishops of Sydney and you know, people who are quite high up in these organisations. So it's not like it's just some mad offshoot opinion. It's it's hardcore belief, well entrenched in the mainstream ideology of these groups.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's absolutely absurd.
Hmm. Just seeing we were on Q&A, did you see it on Monday night?
I did, yes. Hmm. Well, I watched it on...
Yes, because you like to watch it the repeat or the in your own good time afterwards. Yeah.
On iView, I watched it, yep.
Because except when you're podcasting, you're tucked up in bed by 8 o'clock, Scott, is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's it, yeah. That's me, yeah.
Anyway, on it, they had a panel, and they were discussing the fact that we've had 5 prime ministers in 5 years. And the question was, you know, what does the world think of us? You know, we've got 5 prime ministers in 5 years. What does the world think of us? You know, the shame that we must be feeling. And there was a Chinese expert, Asian expert on there, and he was good because the others had all said things along the lines of, you know, well, of course they, you know, want us to get our act into gear and blah, 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 blah. And he came out and said, well, look, you know, government's a big institution, and just changing the prime minister, like, essentially, relationships with other countries pretty much continue the way they normally do, and it's no big deal, so get over it.
Yeah.
And I really like that. But I also, I turn this around and I would go, well, and because I was talking about the American alliance as well and relying on America, you know, if hostilities occur somewhere, we can rely on America and stuff like that. And so I was thinking, well, don't worry about 5 prime ministers in 5 years. What about us looking at the American political system and the clown car that is the Republican candidate group? And aren't we entitled to look at that and go, well, we're not impressed. We're really worried about America. Like, sure, we might have had 5 prime ministers in 5 years, but they could all, any one of them, as much as I despised, you know, Tony Abbott and Kevin Rudd, and, you know, didn't like Julie Gillard, but any one of them would be a better option than any of the Republican candidates that are currently on show. Like, are we entitled to say to America, well, we're worried about our alliance because you might elect Donald Trump? Who knows what could happen if that's the case? Like, aren't we entitled to turn around and look around the world and say that?
Well, one would have thought so, considering just how, you know, we've got troops that are currently under American control, basically, in the Middle East right now.
Mm.
We've also got troops, you know, we've also got Australian forces that are under American control up in Pearl Harbor and all the rest of it too. So, yeah, I would have thought that's quite a reasonable thing to actually assert.
Yeah. And, you know, I could see the tweets occurring at the bottom of the screen at Q&A, and people are saying, you know, we need our alliance with America, and, you know, if there's trouble, you know, they'll be here to support us, etc.
Well, I'm not so sure of that, you know.
Don't be so sure of that. And, you know, the war had been going on for quite a while, the Second World War, before America stepped in.
I remember
bombing in Pearl Harbor might have had something to do with that.
Well, exactly. You know, and that was exactly the point, was that the Americans joined because they were bombed into it. You know, they didn't join because it was the right thing to do. They joined because they were bombed into it.
Yeah. So I just keep viewing the alliance with America as one that increasingly is going to get us into trouble rather than keep us out of trouble. And
you know, that's probably not a bad way to look at it, really.
Mm, yeah. Mm. So speaking of getting us into trouble, just briefly on Syria. Had Russia got involved last week?
They had.
Did we talk about that?
Like, we did talk about them, yep.
I just think, I've been thinking about it since, and this is the ideal opportunity to pull out. This is where we say it's fantastic that another superpower has entered the fray and is going to support the recognised Assad government, and it's just too messy if we all stay. It's much closer to their region. Good on you, Russia, for becoming involved and seeking a solution. And we'll pull out and watch from the sidelines and cheer and clap and hope things go well for you. Like Putin thinks he's pulled a master stroke, and he has to some extent, because he knows that, you know, he can do whatever he'd like and there really won't be any repercussions.
Well,
but I reckon he's not counting on him pulling out. And I reckon this is a great opportunity for America and Australia and the others to say, fantastic, Russia's taken control and we're not the world's cop on this one. Good on you, Vladimir, and let us know if you need any sort of advice along the way. So, yeah.
And that is exactly the right thing for us to do, too. We should actually pull out and say, well, the Russians are here now. They don't need us anymore.
Yeah. So, you know. So they can determine a winner amongst the motley crew there, and it's in their region, and I reckon it's an ideal opportunity, but... you know, I'm not in charge of world negotiations in Syria, Scott, but maybe somewhere out there, there's some think tank in America is listening in on the Iron Fist Fellow Globe podcast and going, holy smokes, that's a good idea. But I wouldn't count on it.
Well, I wouldn't be counting on it either, but, you know.
Yeah. And another topic I had... there's a link on the website, was a commentary from a Greens candidate, Scott.
Yes, that was an interesting one to read.
Yeah, and I'll get my hands on it now. This is from John Kaye.
John Kaye.
Greens member of New South Wales Parliament, yeah. And he's made a point, which has probably been obvious to us for a while, but... talking about these radicalised Muslim students who are potentially being radicalised in prayer groups in schools, and he is saying, well, the Christian lobby has something to answer for here, because they lobby for prayer time in school time and get it. So then, of course, any religious group can do the same, and hence we have crazy Muslim students proselytising to other crazy, well, to potentially crazy Muslims and converting them, all happening during prayer groups. And, you know, the Baird government leaving it up to principals to regulate this, how on earth... is a principal going to maintain control over half a dozen different prayer groups occurring at lunchtime and monitor them? Like, how's that going to work?
Yeah, I mean, clearly it's not going to, but I mean, yeah.
So
it was very good for him to enter and say what we've both been thinking for quite some time, and, you know, he's hit the nail right on the head.
So the beauty of the secular party and... Iron Fist, Velvet Glove, Scott, is that because we are against all religions, then we can say we don't want any prayers in public schools or publicly funded schools during school hours, and get rid of all of them. And that way you can get rid of the Christian groups who are annoying, and the Muslim groups who are scary. So, you know, so that's one of the benefits of not being aligned with a group, with a religious group, is because we're against them all. We're not anti-Muslim in that sense. We want them all out. We genuinely want all religions out of public schools, and the Christian lobby has created a problem for Australia.
Yeah, and they have created a problem for Australia, and, yeah.
Mm. And finally, Scott, it would not be a Iron Fist Velvet Glove podcast without a quick mention of the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yes, you've got a real hobby horse here.
I do. It's turned into a hobby horse, hasn't it? And Malcolm Turnbull said... of the TPP, that it was of enormous benefit to us. It is a gigantic foundation stone for our future prosperity. That's a worry.
Yeah.
Mm. So I got a link to an article by John Menadue, who I've mentioned in the past, has a blog called Pearls and Irritations. and he's very much anti-TPP, and he's come up with some very famous and learned people. And
such as Ross Gittins.
Yes. So, Ross Gittins, economics editor, Sydney Morning Herald, says the TPP is no big deal. Alan Mitchell, Australian Financial Review editor, it's more of a pebble than a gigantic foundation stone. Leon Berkelmans, director of the Lowy Institute, TPP is stifling rather than sustaining. Don't get sucked into the lofty rhetoric. It's wrong. Ian Verender, ABC business editor. It is about entrenching the interests of major corporations at the expense of ordinary citizens. Michael West, Sydney Morning Herald. It's a leg up for vested interests. And Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel laureate in economics and professor at Columbia University. It's an agreement to manage its members' trade and investment and to do so on behalf of each country's most powerful business lobbies. Make no mistake, it is not about free trade.
Yeah, it's all a bit ugly, really, isn't it?
And
you know, and it makes it, we get down here further, and the point is made about the ISDS provisions. You know, there's, anyway.
It also makes an interesting point that apparently, Scott, in 2003, the World Trade Organization tried to promote a multilateral free trade, but this was sabotaged by the US because they didn't want to reduce agricultural protection for their US farmers. So they sabotaged that, and in response, they've launched the TPP, which still protects their US farming interests and isolates China. So... So, once again, as in so many other fields, we are paying a very heavy price for our unthinking support for the US. So,
yeah, agreed.
I think I'm starting to bash the USA as much as I am the Catholic Church, Scott.
Well, you certainly are certainly sounding like it. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm giving them a good go. But,
look, you know, I mean, but there are, you know, it's not just you that's saying it. There are people that do actually know a lot about economics.
Yes.
That you've already mentioned.
Yes.
You know, and they're not all socialist idiots. You know, Ross Gittins is not a socialist idiot.
Yes.
You know, these people are sensible, published economists, and they are having some questions about it. So, you know, if they've got questions, if they've raised questions about it, then frankly, we should all be raising questions about it.
And some of those comments are more than questions, aren't they? They're pretty blunt assessments.
Absolutely. Yeah, they really are. And, you know, well, where was it? Don't believe the hype the TPP is stifling rather than sustaining. Well, you know, I mean, this is Leon Berkelmans from Director of Lowy Institute. You know, it's just... Yeah.
So just on Malcolm Turnbull, then, you know, he seems, worries me, he's going to be in support of it, but generally, your opinions on Malcolm and what he's been up to?
Oh, Malcolm Turnbull, I think, is far superior as a Prime Minister than the one that we've just recently lost.
Yes.
He's certainly much better than the one we've just recently lost. Having said that, though, yes, it's a concern about the TPP, for sure. But all in all, I think Turnbull is a preferable sort of person to have in the lodge than the one that we've just lost.
Yeah, I mean, his talk is less inflammatory, and he's more conciliatory in his approach. Actual things that will change, it seems like he's, in order to get the job, he had to cut a few deals of not changing things. Would that be right?
And that'd be exactly right. Yes, he has. He has cut a lot of... He has clearly made some deals to get himself over the line. Go on.
No, just really, you know, whether he... jury's still out very much for me as to what he actually does. He sounds... makes all the right noises, but then Kevin Rudd used to make all the right noises as well in the early days, and look how that turned out.
Well, he certainly did make the right noises. anyway, we'll see where it goes. But you're right, it is only early days right now, and we'll see what happens.
The other topic, Scott, was just on electoral law reform and proposals about voting changes. So we are obviously one of the most minor of the minor parties, and some of these rules are pretty critical to us. So what's going on there?
Look, this is the perennial question about reforming the laws under which you elect the Senate. And they do come up from time to time, and they've particularly come up in the last time round, because in the last federal election, Ricky Muir was elected with only 0.5% of the primary vote. Where do we go from here? I'm assuming you're going to put this up on the website, but there is a there will be a link to a thing that's from the Electoral Royal Commission. Let's talk about electoral reform, it says. The electoral system does a poor job of bringing this about, imposing a simplistic two-party model which creates a poor standard of debate and widespread alienation among the unrepresented population. Bang on the money. Whoever it is that wrote this, he could just pack up and go home for the rest of the week because he's hit the nail right on the head in that opening line. So sorry, what were you going to say?
I think the primary vote for which is not for the major parties is like
23.54% of the population voted for a party other than the ALP, the Coalition and the Greens.
Yeah. So it appears that the other... We'll call them the four majors.
Yeah. The two majors. You've got the ALP and the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party's got on off to its right the National Party,
yes.
And the ALP has off to its left the Greens.
It's kind of hard to call the National Party a major party, isn't it? Because
They're bigger than the Greens, huh?
Yeah. So anyway, so. They all have looked at the motoring enthusiast win and thought they don't like the way that panned out in the way the preference deals were done. Keeping those votes within the minor parties and not allowing them to leach out into the major parties meant that Ricky Muir got in. So.
Yeah.
They're basically proposing changes to the system, Scott, so that doesn't happen. Is that right?
Essentially, yes. Basically, what it is their major problem with it was the preference whisperer, who was the name something or other, Drury, I think his surname was. He was the bloke who sat down with the minor parties, or a large section of the minor parties, and said, right, this is the way you guys need to work together so you can get yourselves over the line. The biggest problem was with the Motoring Enthusiast Party because, as I said, of those people that actually gave their first preference to the Motoring Enthusiast Party, it was less than 0.5%. But, to get over 1/6 of it or something like that, you ended up with all these other parties that the preferences flowed to.
Yes. Yep.
So, that's where their main problem is and that's what their main bitch is. And now they've started to move against it, which is fine if you're from someone other than...
Major parties,
precisely. The Liberal Democrats, for example. Let's face it, that bloke got in because of the name recognition problem. Sorry, what are you going to say?
So it's fine if you are one of the major parties, rather.
So
the interesting thing here is this is an issue where the Greens seem to be sidling up with the Labor and the Libs.
Absolutely. And this is the thing with the Greens. The Greens are no longer that sort of fringe element that, how do you say it politely? Well, bugger it. You can't say it politely. They're no longer unelectable idiots.
Yes.
They are now electable and they have won significant numbers of seats. They've got a member up there in the House of Representatives who'll probably be there for the foreseeable future, actually, to be honest. So you've got them already at the table. So they've got their nose firmly in the trough for electoral funding. And they don't want to share that space with anyone else. Hence this move. Now, the move that we have got talked about, and it's not here in the Electoral Reform Commission, but there is... and this is a move that was discussed. Former Victorian Premier Jeff Kennett was the man who said it out loud probably around about 2 months ago. I was watching TV. He came up on an interview there, and he said that one of the things that he hopes happens is that they lock it up and says that you've got to get, if you don't get 5% of your primary vote, then your preferences don't spill anywhere.
Yes.
Now, of that 23.54, that's probably spread across a dozen parties, yep, thereabouts. Bang. Mm. You've then got none of them are going to be spreading any of their, what's the word I'm grabbing for? None of their preferences will go anywhere because they'll have less than 5% of the primary vote.
Yes. Yep.
So that's a hell of a mess, really. Now, what that does is it buggers up people like the Secular Party and the Democrats and everyone else. Mm. It's a hell of a mess. Mm. So while there's certainly an argument that it needs to be changed, there's probably a different article. There's certainly arguments that have been put forward to say, well, okay, that's fine, but let's, rather than throwing the baby out with the bathwater, let's eliminate the group voting, but not completely eliminate it by doing it by saying that you've got to have your first your voting above the line would have to be preference voting. Mm-hmm. So you'd end up filling out the 20-odd people that are above the line. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, that's about it, really. It's just, it is really, it's certainly looking more and more like it's going to be a power grab by the majors. And that's where it's got really, really ugly in my view.
Yeah, I think we'll be talking about this one down the track.
This
is one.
And to be honest, and this is one that the Greens said probably 2-3 months ago. They said you'd be able to tell when the next election's coming because they'll sit down and they'll decide that it's time to put this through.
Right, yep.
Yeah. Mm.
The other thing is that it seems that Ricky Muir, he's probably not that bad, is it? Like,
no, he's been fine. Yeah, he really has been. He's not been he's not been out there sort of big noting himself or anything else. He's been quite responsible.
Yeah, he's approached it in a conscientious and genuine way, it seems.
Exactly. So, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've been actually reasonably impressed with the guy, actually, to be honest.
Yeah. So anyway, if this current system means that guys like Ricky Muir gets in, well, you know, maybe it's not such a bad thing. So,
well, look, I mean, as far as I was concerned, you know, I think that having someone like Ricky Muir every now and again is probably a good thing. Mm. Because what it does is it simply says that the parliament is not just locked up for Malcolm Turnbull and whatnot. It is open to other people that are available
and
can get elected.
And it gives hope to humble members of the Secular Party, Scott, who through a miracle could perhaps one day get somebody up.
Well, yeah, I mean, I suspect we'll probably be flogging that dead horse for a little while yet, but
look, you know, we've talked a lot about Secular Party this time. We don't often give the disclaimer all the time, but I gave a really good disclaimer about episode 2 or 3 and said it just carries on forever, and it still does. And it's basically, we're giving our opinions as the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove, not necessarily the opinions of the Secular Party. So read their Secular Party website for full policy details. But more often than not, it'll be pretty close to what we say.
Mm.
Yeah. Or at least what you say, Scott.
Well.
Yeah. All right, Scott, well, I reckon it's a bit of an early episode, this one. So
it's certainly looking that way, yes, so absolutely.
I reckon that we will call it a night and we will continue. I think some of the things tonight will... certainly this Human Rights Commission roundtable, I'd be very surprised if there's not some news on that next week. And we'll continue with that then.
Yeah, I'd say so. And also, you know, the Human Rights Commission and the electoral voting reform for the Senate, those things will continue into the future for sure.
Yeah. So, good night, listeners. Thank you for listening.
Everybody, thank you very much for listening in.
Catch you next time.
Bye now. Bye.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing
something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.